there is an extreme need for stability and control. And I think these personal factors, which we rarely discuss in international relations, are also playing out into how China behaves today internationally.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
It seems everyone is talking about China these days. They're not just talking about the origins or the long-term impact of COVID, but there's considerable global attention on Beijing's tense relationship with Washington, with Ottawa, with New Delhi, with Tokyo, and with some European capitals. But China wields considerable influence in large parts of the world, including in many low and medium income countries, and it does so through a long history of foreign aid, but also more recent large investments in infrastructure projects. In recent years, Beijing has built on this long history of development diplomacy and has steadily expanded its global influence through a relatively new signature foreign policy project initiated in 2013. This is the Belt and Road Initiative, a long-term plan to undertake a series of large investments in roads, bridges, gas pipelines, railways, ports, and power plants in over 70 countries. And if you've listened to a previous episode on this podcast, you will be familiar with some of the debates around the Belt and Road Initiative. Joining me today to discuss the role and impact of China's long history of foreign aid and investments around the world is Marina Rudiak. Marina is an assistant lecturer at the Institute of Chinese Studies at Heidelberg University in Germany. She studied modern and classical Chinese studies and public law at Heidelberg University and Shanghai International Studies University. In her recently completed PhD dissertation, Marina focuses on Chinese foreign aid policies and Beijing's evolving role in international development. Before rejoining Heidelberg University in 2014, Marina was a policy advisor with the German Agency for International Cooperation, or GIZ, in Beijing, where she managed a multi-country project on regional economic cooperation. She also has considerable experience in working with projects on South-South cooperation. I began by asking Marina what, according to her, is the Chinese perspective on current world events and how she sees this play out in a post-COVID world.
Hello, Dan. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. How the Chinese are viewing this world event? I mean, that's a very interesting question because I think we have to differentiate between the Chinese and the Chinese leadership. And a general trend we observe since 2013, since Xi Jinping acceded to power, is this wider shift in China's foreign policy, with China becoming much more proactive, which is a very strong moving away from the policy which was set out by Xi Jinping, by Deng Xiaoping, this hide your potential and bide your time, which we have been seeing China doing basically since then till Xi acceded to power. And when Xi was, I think, giving his first or the second speech in the at the party congress, he talked about the centenary goals. And one of the centenary goals is for China returning to the center of the world, to a place it in the official history lost during the Opium Wars. So what we're seeing now is China asserting or trying to assert to a place which the Chinese leadership as of now believes to be its legitimate place as one of the major powers at the center of the world stage, one that is shaping global affairs and not simply following like it had been happening in the past.
That brings me to this issue of China not wanting to be a rule taker, but a rule maker, this interest in becoming much more of a country that is trying to actually shape global governance, being a bit more proactive. A lot of people are really worried that maybe China is maybe, you know, taking on too much at the same time. It's just, why engage into all of these sort of fraught relations with so many actors all over the world? Why now?
So on the question of, you know, China not wanting to be a rule taker, but a rule maker, I think we have to see it in a differentiated way. China does not want to overturn the multilateral system as it is, because it extremely benefited from it. But if we look at how China communicates officially, it's talking about the democratization of international relations and having a bigger say for developing countries, which per se is understandable. But when China talks about having a bigger say for the developing countries, it understands itself as leading the voice of the developing countries. So how democratic it is something we can discuss. I think, you know, on your question, why now? I come from a systemic perspective. So I think with, you know, starting with US pivot to Asia still under Obama, and now, of course, following with Trump and the trade war, I think things started moving in a way that it has developed a certain own dynamic. Now, if you look at the core interests of the Chinese Communist Party, it's first of all keeping the party in power, maintaining the territorial integrity of China, so no separation of Tibet, Xinjiang, and no independence declaration by Taiwan, and maintaining a stable international environment that is suitable for China's economic rise. And I think what we are seeing now is a lot of stress responses because these core interests are perceived to be threatened. Now, another major factor which I think plays a role, and there we go into realms of political psychology, is that we have a very interesting leadership generation now, with Xi Jinping being on the one hand a princeling and surrounded by princelings. So there is this idea of inherited power and having the right to rule, but on the other hand, it's an extremely traumatized generation because Xi Jinping himself was a teenager during the Cultural Revolution. His mother committed suicide. His father was purged. Others along him have also gone through the Cultural Revolution in their formative years. So you can imagine, just on a personal level, there is an extreme need for stability and control. And I think these personal factors, which we rarely discuss in international relations, are also playing out into how China behaves today internationally.
Those are fascinating perspectives, Marina. While, of course, China is entering into these more sort of disagreements or these sort of conflicts with many other countries, what appears beyond doubt is that Beijing has, in fact, endeared itself to many countries all over the world. It is not just aid and investments in low-income countries of Africa or Asia, but also major infrastructure projects that China is constructing in medium and high-income countries. And so some have been claiming that this is really something, the infrastructure aspect is something that the West has been neglecting for a long time, and China's role is therefore very welcome. So there's this kind of a positive narrative, the aspect, the gap that needs to be filled, and China is the one doing so. And the same thing can perhaps be said of this so-called South-South cooperation that I know that you've been doing research on, South-South cooperation as in China, India, many other countries are providing assistance that is often anchored in their own development experiences and perhaps more appealing to so-called recipient countries than Western solutions or Western approaches that may not seem to be as close to their needs. So I wonder whether we could now begin by discussing the issue or the evolving architecture, as you see it, of Chinese development aid or development assistance. And what can you tell us about the history of aid and investments that China has been providing? And how is such aid being potentially used as a foreign policy tool?
On the case that there is also a positive narrative about China, you're absolutely right. And the interesting thing about China is how in Western, or let's say rather in Euro-American perspectives, we try to simplify China to, you know, one statement: China is this or China is that. While China, like any other country, is complex. And while we have no problem saying that the United States can commit errors like Guantanamo or the invasion of Iraq, and at the same time be probably one of the biggest actors in protecting human rights, we try to simplify China to either only being evil or, you know, being a force for global development. And this is extremely complex. So China does play a really important role in building global infrastructure and providing development assistance to sectors and to countries where the northern development assistance has left a gap. And the interesting discourse is that although the North very well knows that a lot of the approaches done did not work, it still very often pretends to know it better than China, while China actually exports just what it had experienced as successful at home. And the history of Chinese aid goes back more or less to the foundation of the People's Republic of China in 1949, with China starting to give aid first to North Korea during the Korean War and then to Vietnam in 1950, and then to socialist countries in 54, and expanding to African countries in after 55, after Bandung. And back then, foreign aid was very much a foreign policy tool to break through the international isolation China was faced with after the founding of the PRC. So there was an international embargo. China was not internationally recognized. The attempts by Nehru, the leader of India back then, to have China included in the United Nations General Assembly failed. So Chinese foreign aid, then largely shaped by Zhou Enlai, was used in a way to establish trade and diplomatic relations. Now, the interesting part back then is that Western aid was extremely conditional and back then very often linked to either military support or purchase of economic goods. The latter is something we criticize today on China, by the way, with Chinese aid being conditional. So China was, the Chinese approach back then was very much in opposition to Western aid, namely providing foreign aid without any political conditions in the framework of South-South cooperation and through that receiving economic contacts and then later diplomatic recognition, which in 1971 led to China, with the huge support of African countries, mostly being voted into the United Nations General Assembly and a Republic of China of Taiwan being voted out. So this is kind of the beginnings of Chinese aid. Now, if we move then later into 80s, when, you know, after Mao Zedong has died and Zhou Enlai died and Deng Xiaoping came to power, the Chinese government understood that it had been spending way beyond its possibilities. In the 70s, China was spending 2% of its GDP on aid. Now, if you remember, the developed economies have agreed to spend to the target of 0.7% of the GDP. And to my knowledge, only five countries have reached it so far. China was spending 2% in the 70s. So the Chinese leadership in the early 80s started talking about that actually China cannot afford to continue spending that much, and was actually looking to India and to the Indian way of synergizing aid with trade and investment. And in 1982 came up with a policy with the four principles of economic and technical cooperation, which very much resembled the Indian approach. Nobody talks about that. It's actually not very known, but if you compare the policies, you see that it's basically more or less the same. And till mid-90s, Chinese aid was basically charitable. China was giving loans, but most of them were not repaid. So, and China never pressed on the repayment of loans. So it took till 1995, where they started to copy the Japanese approach of concessional loans. And this is something we see till today, so which is still kind of dominating how China provides aid. So the in a nutshell, the story of Chinese aid is very much a global story, which was guided by responses to the West, but also very often adapted ideas from both from the West and from other southern countries.
In the Western media, and particularly, let's say, in the American media, Chinese interest in, let's say, Africa or many other parts of the world is often portrayed as more of a recent event, whereas what you're saying basically is that it has been going on for many, many years, except that, say, two decades ago, the volume of aid and investments was suddenly stepped up, right? So there was this going out policy, and suddenly this more, I suppose, visible change or increase in volume of aid and investments caught the attention of the world community. So how do you see the last two decades of Chinese activities? Do you see a big difference in the way in which charity or a charity-focused approach has led the way to something more, such much more focus on loans, concessional loans, the construction of mega projects? How would you characterize the big differences between the first phase and the more recent two decades of Chinese activity?
So, as you say, China and Africa is by no means a recent event. And funny fact, in the 70s, there was huge discussion in the United States, but also in Europe about Chinese aid to Africa. But then when China became a recipient of DAC ODA in 80, we suddenly stopped looking. It's because I think in our imaginative geographies, you can either be a recipient or a donor, but not one and the other at the same time. Now, what happened in 1995 is that the Chinese government, back then actually the Minister of Trade, Wu Yi, passed a policy which was specifically directed at using aid to support the going global of Chinese companies. And this was actually 4 years before the official going global policy was passed in 1999. So the idea was to use aid in a way that it would subsidize Chinese companies going abroad, and through intergovernmental agreements provide a safe space for them to go abroad. The rationale for that was that the Chinese government evaluated that Chinese companies, as they were not strong enough to survive on international markets. Now, how it worked is that the then newly founded China Exim Bank was providing normal market rate loans, which were subsidized by the Chinese government. And actually, only the subsidy part was foreign aid budget. But through this subsidy, the whole loan was counted as foreign aid. So the aid figures appear much larger than they are by the budget. And one other reason for this policy was also to a response to the international embargo China was facing after Tiananmen. So it was looking for ways to secure the support of developing countries in combination with supporting the internationalization of its industry. And then the model took off because it basically, it was a response to the needs of especially African countries. Because after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, the aid of the Eastern Bloc disappeared. And due to the recession in the United States and the UK, their aid volumes dropped too. Japan was in recession, so Japanese aid volumes dropped too. So I think the if I remember the number correctly, aid to sub-Saharan Africa in the 90s declined by 40%. And then China stepped in. So basically it filled the gap that was left by those who were providing aid before that.
One aspect that you've already alluded to, and I'd like you to further expand on, really has to do with how aid is defined. Because one of the big complaints or one of the problems that researchers have or policymakers outside China have is trying to figure out what constitutes aid and what constitutes investment. And the fact that there is very little data disaggregated, not often at a country level or not according to sectors, etc., makes it very difficult to understand what is given, who gets what, for what, and for what purpose. And so in my own work, for example, I've had to rely on speeches of Chinese ambassadors and visiting officials, media reports, to try and construct an idea of what is being given. So I wondered whether you could reflect a bit on how the definition or understanding of aid in China differs perhaps from the more OECD DAC definition of aid.
With the OECD DAC definition in mind, the idea is that aid is supposed to be charitable. And as we know, the OECD DAC has certain conditionality criteria, but the dominant core is that aid is supposed to be charitable. Now, if you look at how aid is discussed in the Chinese context, we see that anything in the range of you need it, we have it, can be termed as aid. If it's charitable, it can be aid. If you need something and I sell it to you, it can also be termed aid. This is something we saw in the context of COVID, for example, that when the Chinese government was selling masks and equipment to other countries and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs tweeted that China was helping. Now, Western journalists said, but wait, they are misguiding us because it was not aid. But from the Chinese perspective, it is aid because we have it, you need it. Now, when we come to official finance, and this is where, as you said, it gets very difficult. It's extremely blurry and difficult to disentangle because official finance packages would typically consist of a mix of grant component, an interest-free loan, and a large part of a concessional loan. In China, you can, as far as you get the data, you could disaggregate what is counted as the Chinese foreign aid budget and what not. And only grants, interest-free loans, and concessional loans provided by the China Exim Bank are counted as foreign aid budget. Preferential buyers credits, export credits, all the loans provided by the China Development Bank are not counted as foreign aid. But if you look at how Chinese officials talk about official flows or Chinese loans, even if it's a completely commercially built road, the ambassador opening this road will be talking about aid. And this is why it's so extremely difficult to disentangle this if you don't speak Chinese and can't actually look up in which line of the budget is the money.
This is the interesting part, because even though you have the Chinese private sector, if you can call them the private sector at all, I mean, most of them have some ties with the state, and major state-owned companies are also building projects. So anything coming from the Chinese private sector is, of course, as you rightly point out, sold as a gift or an assistance package from the Chinese government. But when I speak to Chinese companies, they sometimes are a little dissatisfied. They feel that they don't really get much assistance from their local embassies by way of subsidies or even from the local government. So they feel that perhaps the government is taking more credit than it should. I wanted to pursue one angle here, which is the popularity, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, of the Chinese aid model. As you were alluding to earlier, it is based on, you know, I have something and you need something and let's do business. It is this principle of win-win, mutual respect, solidarity, non-intervention in political affairs. These are the official principles on which China has been promoting its activities, at least on the African continent. But in Western capitals and elsewhere, the reception has been a bit mixed. So while some say this is great because they're doing things that we're not doing, others worry about the lack of conditionality or the impact on good governance. So do you think this kind of activity in the last two decades has been largely win-win? Or do you see, do you see certain major challenges with this model that China is currently pursuing?
I think we have to look at the sectors. I think it's extremely sector depending. I mean, if we look at China's investment in telecommunication, for example, which was mostly implemented by Huawei, but also by ZTE, with state loans, but not aid loans. And Huawei is a private company. Well, it claims to be, at least. On that, the discourse in the West is that, well, China is pushing its telecommunication standards on the African continent. This is certainly true, but at the same time, it lowered the prices for mobile telecommunication by 60%, making it accessible to the normal population. Something, you know, an offer the West did not, non-Western company gave. There will be other areas of, and, you know, probably natural resources extraction, mining, you know, where the question of win-win would be an extremely controversial one, where you could on the one hand say, okay, it gives countries the possibilities to get a loan, but being, you know, not having to borrow in a foreign currency. But on the other hand, we do not price environmental degradation and the negative impacts of certain segments of population. So for the win-win story, we really have, you know, to look sector by sector and disaggregate. And there will be parts where, you know, where it works well, and there will be parts where it doesn't work at all. But I think, coming from the Western perspective, there is, if we are truly honest, actually extremely little knowledge of what is really happening on the ground and what are, you know, the real benefits and negative sides from the Chinese engagement. And I think the Western gaze is still very much dominated by an Orientalist perspective, believing that the West knows how Africa should develop, which is, of course, nonsense. Now, the Chinese side also, in a way, thinks they know how Africa should develop, but their rhetoric, their public diplomacy is a completely different one. They come in by saying, you know, we are brothers, we've been working together since the 1950s, and kind of we are equal, while the West comes in and says, we know what you should do. And this is, I think, very logically, while the perception of China tends to be more positive than the perception of the West. I mean, it's kind of very easy and human to understand.
Yeah, so I actually agree with that totally. In fact, in many of my interactions with international and national policymakers over the years, I've been making the argument that the Chinese diplomatic efforts, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, have been far superior than Western efforts. maybe the intentions are more of the same, but China is better able to package it, to sell the idea, to give the impression, and this is important, I think, that China also appreciates or wants something in return from African countries. Most often the perception that African leaders get from Western countries is that they should just receive but not give anything back. This idea of giving something back makes a lot of people feel important, that it's not like they're useless countries. They also have cotton, not just oil or tobacco or something. So I think this kind of strategy that China has pursued of making African countries feel important has been crucial, and that perhaps explains why in several surveys, including by Afrobarometer, the Chinese model is seen to be quite popular. In fact, one of the most popular on the continent.
In my dissertation, I suggested the term relational aid, which is a little bit grounded in gift theory. And this is something, as you rightly said, particular about Chinese aid, that its underlying assumption is reciprocity. And according to Marcel Mauss, gift theory, who studied the ritual of giving in various societies, expecting a reciprocation awards the recipient of the gift status. So it awards the expectation that the recipient can reciprocate and makes him equal to the giver. And critical development scholars have criticized that in Western aid, that the possibility to reciprocate has been excluded in this model. So this charitable gift creates a vertical relationship and makes the recipient inferior, which is why the Chinese model is perceived positively, because it makes the recipient equal in status.
I'm so happy that you mentioned Mauss, because we've just started a project looking at the role of India in Africa using gift theory, mainly looking at frugal innovation attempts, or India's attempts to project frugal innovation in Africa. You're absolutely right about this, and I think this has been underestimated. The fact that there's nothing like a free gift, there's always something, right? I mean, just acknowledging, saying thank you in itself is conveying some sort of a relationship that, you know, I am maybe inferior or superior, I'm more powerful, I'm grateful. I know in the context of, say, Malawi, a country that I've been studying for long, the role of donations, you know, these pictures in the newspapers, be it Chinese ambassadors or Indian ambassadors or Western ambassadors giving something and a minister there receiving it and saying thank you. So these are these powerful images of reciprocity or something. And I think that is going back to what I was saying earlier about just making people feeling proud that I'm not just saying thanks, but I'm also able to export something to China. I think that makes people feel important. I wanted to return to this gift theory and South-South cooperation. Do you think, and I know you've been studying this animal called South-South cooperation, if you can call it, what is it? I mean, is it really something that holds potential for the future? Do you think this is really something that can change development systems, global development in the next few decades? Or is this South-South cooperation simply a tool by countries like India and China to promote their own businesses in other parts of the world?
I'm an absolute believer in South-South cooperation. And I think actually that Western aid should shift its role into becoming a facilitator of South-South cooperation instead of being what it now is, kind of the money and knowledge provider, or whether it wants to be. And the reason why I'm such a believer in South-South cooperation is actually a very practical one. Now, in my previous life, before I returned to academia, I was a German aid professional working for GIZ. And I was managing a regional economic cooperation project in China, which looked at regional economic cooperation, trade facilitation, cross-border cooperation between peripheral regions of China and neighboring countries. And one thing that we realized when looking at the neighbors is that, and what we often did is actually we would bring regional actors together to discuss on the same topic, and we would have Kyrgyz and Bangladeshi sitting on the same table and saying, oh, we have the same issue in our textile production. Oh, you solved it this way. How wonderful. Oh, we should adapt that. And one of the issues I was working on was a single window for trade administration. And we did a workshop in Mongolia with the Mongolian Trade Administration, where we invited experts from Kyrgyzstan and from Tajikistan who have been going through the same process 5 years earlier. Now, at that time, the Asian Development Bank had offered a loan to Mongolia, which would made it adapt the Korean system. And in this process, our Mongolian counterpart said, but wait, you know, what the Koreans are offering us is way too big because we don't have a huge port. We export a very small line of products. I mean, we don't really need this. On the other hand, what the Kyrgyz and the Tajiks are doing is actually very much closer to what we need. And this is the essence of South-South cooperation, that it allows to transfer the knowledge created under similar conditions and to be adapted then locally easily because the development gaps are not that huge. And therefore, when we talk about South-South cooperation, we should not be looking only at China and India, but actually at much, much smaller countries and the potential of knowledge transfer between them. And Kyrgyzstan, for example, actually adapted a lot in its single window from Senegal, which was, I think, the first country to set up an export-import single window without any donor money. And I went there on a study tour with a delegation from Central Asia, and it was amazing because it was IT-based, but on the other hand, there was also a counter for traders who were illiterate. And if you come up with this creative solution, a country in a similar situation will adopt that. If you come in, you know, with a very advanced solution, it will be too far away. Now, the interesting thing in China is that the Chinese solutions by now are quite advanced, but the point where they were really poor and not developed is not too far in the past. So when China is exporting solutions, first they can, I think they can still see the local less developed conditions. They can integrate their past knowledge, and they are still much, much more flexible, you know, just going in and trying things out, which northern actors rarely do. They come in with a fixed project proposal, your defined goal, your milestones, and expect things to work. The Chinese come in and say, okay, we don't know how it will work out, but we see your problem and we'll try and figure out on the way. And I think this is the difference between South-South and North-South cooperation, this mindset.
But South-South cooperation has been going on for a while. It's not something new. And I was reading some of the literature on this, and it turns out that despite these ambitious commitments and also UN-led events, major conferences, this whole SSC or South-South cooperation aspect has been much more rhetorical than actual implementation. There hasn't been much money. So do you see that change? Why has it not really caught on? It still seems to be in phase one. It just needs to be in a high gear. Am I wrong?
I think a lot of South-South cooperation is simply not visible because at least in the northern discourses, we are aware of things when there is a lot of writing about it. And if you look at who is writing, who is quoted, it's all the same northern guys. So I don't think that South-South cooperation today is where it was in the 1950s, by no means. But it's, of course, I mean, it's much less money and it's extremely disproportionately represented because the discourse is still extremely much northern dominated. And those people who do South-South cooperation mostly have no time to write a lot about it. and don't have the power of researchers in their countries in the same way as we have it in the global north, you know, like you and me to do research and to Twitter and to spread information. And northern researchers are still mostly not very much looking into what's happening in the global south, but rather if we look at literature on south-south cooperation, you will find more comparative perspectives than actually analysis of projects and strategies and what's working.
I have actually had a look, and it turns out, and I see the potential. Mind you, I don't disagree with you about the potential. All I'm saying is that there is that potential hasn't really been achieved. There's just so much that one could have done, and sometimes it appears to be major missed opportunities. But there's this other aspect that this South-South umbrella, cooperation umbrella, involves very diverse group of countries, right? So it isn't as if all these countries agree on one approach, or there are various approaches that fall under this broad umbrella. And just to take the rivalry between India and China as an example, you will see very different approaches being promoted under this South-South cooperation umbrella. India realizes it can't catch up in terms of infrastructure projects. So it goes into IT and online telemedicine and tele-education, kind of frugal innovation or health, whereas China is doing all of these major aspects. And Brazil is limited in terms of some countries. So there is that kind of heterogeneous response in this under this South-South cooperation umbrella. What do you think of that? Do you think there is unity? Is there an agreement that this is SSC?
Well, the major difference between South-South cooperation and North-South cooperation is that the latter is institutionalized, right? South-South cooperation is not institutionalized. And it's, if you ask the question, is there unity? I mean, there is unity in diversity. There are, I would say, a certain set of principles, countries who identify their cooperation as South-South cooperation agree on mutual benefit, and, you know, South-South cooperation being a horizontal relationship and political non-conditionality being this main principles. But because there is no standardized set of practices, no standardized agreements, no standardized relationship patterns as we have it in North-South cooperation with the DAC, it appears to be, you know, much more scattered and, you know, diverse, disorganized. There are many ways to name it. The question, however, is this a problem? Or is this rather an opportunity? And coming from the northern perspective, we tend to see it as a problem and, you know, much potential but missed opportunities. On the other hand, you could ask the same question, I would say, for northern aid. And you could similarly ask how much potential was missed due to the standardized patterns, due to the North saying, this is how we give you aid, this is how we will support you, and this is what we will not do. I mean, if you could also ask how much potential was missed through the structural adjustment programs. So you see, my perspective here is much more a critical one. So I see this diversity as an opportunity if you take cooperation as a process and not as an objective.
So, Marina, let's move on to or return to China and this big, huge initiative called the Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI. And what is particularly interesting about the BRI, I mean, there are many aspects that can be discussed, but what is particularly interesting is that this is not just confined to low-income countries, increasingly BRI activities are taking place also in Europe. The original Belt and Road has now been expanded to most parts of the world. And many countries, many international organizations have, until recently, I suppose, before COVID, been praising the importance of Chinese investments, not just for bridges, but also for telecommunications, for ports. And there again, we see a polarized discourse because some see the BRI as Chinese party, Chinese propaganda, or this kind of quest for much more global supremacy of being, a major world power. Others see it as businesses, and still others see it as just fantastic. These are attempts at creating infrastructure projects, even in Europe, let's say in Greece or Italy, that governments have been struggling to fund for a very long time. So I wondered whether you could reflect a bit on the global impact of the BRI now during COVID. Do you think all of this will change the response? Will we see countries renegotiating their contracts? We already see reports of countries like Pakistan showing or expressing dissatisfaction with current projects and wanting to renegotiate. And you've read both the arguments for and against what China's done in Sri Lanka with the Hambantota ports, etc. So what is your take on the BRI today?
For one, BRI is still today very difficult to assess because it is not an institution. It's not an organization. It's rather, as Yuan Yuanang described it, it resembles a political campaign and a label that has been put on most kinds of Chinese engagements China had been doing pre-BRI already. So when talking about BRI, we have to keep in mind that how much did it change actually? Now, what we have since BRI, of course, is an increase in Chinese lending to certain countries, regions, and sectors. Or rather, we can say we had it since 2015, but in the last 2 years, we can see that there is a readjustment happening as the Chinese government realized how vulnerable many of these loans are, and the potential of them being repaid is a risky issue, which has become more costly than in the past due to the trade war with the United States. Now, the interesting thing, in the Western discourse is the debt trap debate. How much is China consciously trying to entrap countries? And you mentioned the case of Pakistan and Sri Lanka. I mean, on Sri Lanka specifically, there has been just recently a study that by Deborah Breutigam and her team that came out that reconstructed how much the case of Sri Lanka was in fact a case of internal bad management of the Sri Lankan government, which approached China asking, to take over a port that was committed by the previous government in order to free up resources to pay off Eurobonds. And the Chinese agreed and said, okay, let's find a solution and offered a company to manage the port. The port is still owned by Sri Lanka. So it's a really interesting case to look at into how Chinese activity have been misrepresented. From my own research, what I see is that there is less of an intention to bind countries. Also because, de facto, if a country does not repay, there is not much China can do. And this is something we see on a large scale at a case that is not being discussed internationally. And this is Venezuela, which has declared that it cannot repay a really huge loan. I don't have the numbers in my head to China, but Matt Fershen did a nice study on that. And for the most part, it's really bad management. Now, what is difficult to imagine is that till 2017, Chinese policy banks did not have a mandatory credit risk management system in place. They were ordered to establish only in 2017. The leadership of the China Development Bank, which is the world's largest bilateral borrower, consists almost exclusively of people who came from the China Agricultural Bank. These are people used to managing, you know, rural development in China that are now going out globally. So a lot of bad loans we are seeing is actually a combination of bad management within the Chinese policy banks and also, you know, bad management in recipient countries. And of course, then, you know, when things go wrong, countries use the opportunities to renegotiate, mostly quite successfully.
One of the things that I notice is that this is not just a one-sided kind of an argument. It's not just the criticism from the West. It also seems that China is aware of these criticisms. And in my own interactions, I often hear Chinese officials say, oh, so tell us how the Norwegians are doing things. You know, how can we do much more of the trilateral cooperation with others? I see an interesting development now. Chinese NGOs and Western NGOs are collaborating. This kind of a collaboration between Chinese institutions, Western NGOs in a third country. So there's all of this happening. China has established, as you've written yourself, the SIDCA, the aid agency. So there are these institutional attempts or reforms, but the extent to which China or these reforms will actually help and the extent to which these new institutions that have been created will actually make a difference is, of course, uncertain. What is your take on that? Do you agree that China is actually addressing some of the shortcomings, both of its development aid, but also the BRI in general, learning from the Venezuela case and trying to address this? Or is this not done in a systematic way, but more haphazardly?
So the Horn and Tribesh paper, the Kiel University paper on hidden debt, is, from my point of view, missing the part that this debt is also hidden to China. And this links to what you said. The problem with the Chinese loan management system is that it's extremely fragmented. And this is a legacy from the mid-90s. When they started building up the system, it was largely trial and error based, relying on experimental legislation, you know, things being added until it became a huge institutional conglomerate in which now more than 20 central level institutions are involved in foreign aid and development finance. The problem is that there is virtually no horizontal information exchange within the Chinese system. So all the information has been passed on stovepipe to the State Council and has to be negotiated there. And this makes it extremely difficult for Chinese actors to know how much China is actually lending. Now, there have been talks about setting up statistical systems for foreign aid and foreign lending since a while now, but it has not happened yet. And if you look at the Chinese discourse, they cite the absence of an aid law as a reason. So basically a law that would mandate institutions to cooperate. And this appears to be an extremely difficult problem to solve. There is this belief of, you know, an omnipotent Chinese central leadership, but this is not the case. And ministries and policy banks that are ministries are just not willing to give up their power. And obviously there is no one in the central leadership strong enough to say, cooperate and share your numbers.
Let's move on to Europe, Marina, closer home. Germany. What is China's relationship with the EU, with Germany? I see you tweeting several times. I wouldn't say every day, but every now and then you often argue, at least on social media, that maybe what we really need is much more Chinese expertise or expertise on China in Europe, that policymakers should be relying on evidence-based knowledge rather than pursuing policy priorities without having that kind of a foundation. How do you see the EU-China relationship developing, particularly since the China-US relationship is gradually deteriorating?
If we talk about the image of China, I think it's at a historic low. The perception of China, well, and I've been dealing with China since almost 20 years now, as far as I remember, has never been as bad as it is now. And it's one of the places where we see it is that the EU talks about China as a partner and a strategic competitor or a strategic rival, which is a new dimension. And this has to do with the fact that there has been so little progress in the negotiations between the EU and China on a number of topics. A central problem I see is that the EU is not using the potential it has. And the reason is the asymmetry of knowledge. China indeed knows the EU and the European countries much, much better than vice versa, simply by the fact that there are people who are very much aware of what is being discussed in Europe and what the policies are. And it's not the same in the EU when it comes to China. A general perception I get when talking to European policymakers is that they believe a lot of information in China and from China is censored. And this is simply not the case. Rather, maybe 5 or maximum 10% of openly available, politically relevant information from China is available in translation. So we lack people who can read and decode Chinese policies and provide policy recommendations which are based on factual information. And this leads to misrepresentations that certain things like the social credit system are being completely misrepresented and are being made a bigger problem than it is, while other probably more significantly problematic issues are not discussed at all because nobody bothers to translate them. And this is, I mean, you know, if you look at major European media outlets, you would have a newspaper would have 10 correspondents in the United States, 20 correspondents in the United States, 10 in Brussels and 1 in Beijing. So we get much less information. What I observe is that organizations start realizing that having China specialists sitting in China departments is not enough anymore, that there is a huge lack on global China knowledge. People who deal with Africa who never bothered with China suddenly understand they need China knowledge, and especially what China is doing in Africa. And this is become such a huge gap that actually there needs to be institutional investment in creating this China capacities. And Sweden has just established a China Institute that will be specifically focusing on analyzing China policy, Chinese policies, and providing recommendations. We would need something like that in all European countries and on the EU level. And so far, that's not happening. But the dominant voices on China, if you look around, or let's say the loudest voices, are actually people who don't read Chinese.
So, Marina, final set of issues, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, when we will have perhaps addressed the COVID challenge, when things will perhaps return to some sort of a new normal, how will people in Europe or throughout the world view China? Will the perception of China be radically different from what it was before COVID?
I think it will be different in the sense that more people will have China on their map. Pre-COVID, many organizations could avoid to simply ignore China and to perceive it as something that is, you know, far too distant and not really relevant to us. I think with COVID, this has changed. China has arrived at the center. It's not periphery anymore. And I think this is the major change and the major shift that will influence the perceptions of China.
Marina, it's been such a pleasure to have you on this podcast. Thank you so much.
The pleasure was mine. Thank you for inviting me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is Global Dev Pod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.